yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Now, they brought death to our hometown. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay. Well, last week we talked about Brexit. Well, how can we not talk about Brexit after the historic vote yesterday? What does it all mean? What does it mean for the UK, both economically and politically? What does it mean for the EU, European Union? Obviously, those two are going to be most impacted and initially first impacted, but it will have a contagion effect on the U.S. economy, on Japan, on emerging markets, on China. So it's important to understand the background of all this and where it's going. First off, those who are interested can read on my blog my recent two publications here in the last couple days. And there will be another one here this weekend in which I wrote about Brexit right before the vote. JackRasmus.com is where you go to my blog. These are publications for Telesur, South American media outlet that I write biweekly for, and also for Counterpunch. You can also get just Google it. Just Google me and Google Brexit, and you'll find these articles. Okay. And if you want a longer, more in-depth analysis of the whole European economy, I also put on my website a complimentary chapter from my recent book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, my book, a chapter, I think it was chapter 4 or 5, called Europe's Chronic Stagnation. This is a rather lengthy piece, about 10,000-12,000 words, so it's the origins and history leading up to the crisis 2008 and since then, and why Europe has been in the chronic stagnation in terms of growth in the economy. You know, it's slipped into a double dip recession here in 2011-13, and the recovery has been very weak ever since. At Europe, the EU and the Eurozone barely been growing under the best of times and slipping below growth occasionally. What I call epic recession, in other words, uneven, slow growth, characterized by short, shallow recoveries and short, shallow declines. And as I said many times, that's what's been going on everywhere in advanced economies, including the U.S., although our stop-go short, shallow recoveries and so forth have been a little bit higher in the 1 to 1.5% range. And when we slow down, it's been for a shorter period of time, like a quarter instead of 6 months or more. So it's the same kind of a dynamic going on following the 2008-09 crash. That's what I call an epic recession. We've still been in a recession globally. It's not a depression. It's a recession, but it is a chronic state that has existed ever since 2009. And to the extent they use their measure of GDP, it's only growth for the few, and mostly for those investing in financial assets and so forth. And that's why we see this great discontent of working classes and middle classes and small business ever since 2009. And after 7 years now, people are losing their patience. And that's reflected politically as well as economically, and we see this in the, and I'll talk about it some more, in the UK Brexit vote, but it's going on throughout Europe, and it's occurring here in the US as well. We see a discontent here within the Democratic Party wing, or let's say left to center wing of politics, and a de facto split in the Democratic Party with the Sanders event, although the Democratic Party elites have been able to reestablish it, because you don't really have a true ongoing split in the Democratic Party. It has prevented it, very cleverly kept the Sanders people engaged on its wing, and then when it didn't need them anymore, although it still will in the election in November, it kind of pushes them out the door. So it's not a real split within the Democratic Party, but a de facto split among Democratic elements, you might say. And then, of course, on the right, we have the same thing in the U.S. So we got the Trump versus the rest of the establishment Republican Party split going on. At some point, these splits in the U.S. are going to have to take a organizational form. It can't go on sort of internally. A true split will occur, and other organizational expressions will occur, maybe not before the election, but certainly after the election in November. But we see in the parliamentary systems, the splits are more obvious and they come quicker. We've seen that in the UK, for example. You had this independent party called UKIP, U-K-I-P, which has been promoting and pushing for several years now, as it has grown in influence, exit from the European Union. And you have to understand this Brexit vote in that sense, because it goes back to last year, the May 2015 UK parliamentary elections, where David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, leader of the Conservative Party, was able to prevail, significantly, a true majority in those parliamentary elections last year. And the reason he was able to do that, a major reason, was his offer to the British voters during the campaign run-up, that if they elect him, he will put membership in the UK, in the EU, to a vote, a referendum, an up or down vote. And they elected him, and I think that probably made the big difference. They elected him because they, the voters, the British voters, because they expected to be able to have a vote. Well, in a sense, Cameron struck a Faustian bargain. Now, remember Faust? Faust is this character in classical literature, and Faust was an academic who was discontent that he didn't know enough about, he didn't have enough knowledge, so he struck a deal with the devil in literature here, right? And the deal was, give me the knowledge that I want, and you can have my soul. And the devil, Mephistopheles, agreed. And he got his knowledge, but then at a certain point, the devil says, okay, now you got to pay up. Now I want your soul. So in a sense, we have a similar Faustian bargain that was struck a year ago, 18 months ago, during the British campaign by Cameron, that, okay, voters, I'll put this to a vote to whether stay in the EU or not. Just elect me. Okay, they elected him, and now pay up time. And that was the vote. And it's interesting to watch the run-up to this vote, because, boy, they pulled out all the plugs. The big scare campaign by Cameron and the economic interests who wanted to stay in the EU, economic interest in the UK, wanted to stay in the European Union, primarily the banks. You see, the bankers had a nice deal. The bankers in what's called the City of London, that was the financial sector, which dominates the British economy. It's called the City of London, but we're really talking about the big bankers. You know, London is a global financial center for the world, and It's the place where the trading in the euro currency is primarily concentrated, as well as other currencies. And the UK is under Cameron. You know, he's the representative for the bankers, basically politically. And it's also become is becoming the center for global yuan, Chinese currency trade, right? And all the big banks in the world, you know, it contends. The London contends with New York, which one's bigger, and so forth. But it's the primary industry for the UK. And the Cameron administration there is protecting them, and they want to stay in the EU. One of the consequences we're going to see of this vote, when actual exit does occur, if it does, and I'll explain that point shortly, one of the consequences of the vote is that some of these banks now are going to relocate to the EU, primarily in Paris and Frankfurt. Probably the asset management trade is going to move to Paris, and currency trading will probably move to Frankfurt. So the British banks are going to be harmed here in terms of profit. You know, there was a lot of profit for them to be made by lending, particularly to Eastern Europe, those countries that have fairly recently been added to the European Union, which is a 28 member country member customs union and plus more. So there's a lot of opportunity for British money capital flows into Eastern Europe, but now they're going to have to relocate to compete with German capital and French capital and Dutch capital. They're going to have to relocate into the EU. So that's going to mean a loss of jobs and a movement of finance companies out of London and into the EU, which is going to negatively impact you know, the UK itself in a number of ways. So that's why the British were the Camerons and the bankers were very much intent on staying within the EU. Also, British export-oriented companies wanted to stay within the EU, because what happened once Britain joined the EU is that more and more of its trade oriented towards the EU, and I believe it was something like 47% of all British exports went to the European Union, and a lot of that went to Germany, and I think you know, the UK was Germany's third largest trading partner. You know, those things may change. By the way, that's why Germany has supported the UK remaining in very strongly. There's a close connection between German bankers and London. Not strangely, you know, when we talk about Germany and the problems Germany has caused for the rest of the EU, it's not Germany, it's German bankers who are running the show in not only in Germany, but in these pan-European EU institutions, bureaucracies that have been created, you know, like the European Central Bank, the European Commission, European Parliament, and so forth. These new political institutions that have been created on top of the EU, by the way, which are not very democratic. The people in the UK did not elect these people who are running these commissions and so forth. That's a problem of neoliberalism, by the way. These new banker capitalist dominated and controlled unelected political super political cross country institutions, which are there dominated by you know, the big corporations and the banks for their benefit, and not for the benefit of average folks. And people are beginning to have a problem with that throughout Europe. You see, in this UK vote, Brexit vote, one of the big issues was sovereignty, national sovereignty. When you agree to a customs union, in other words, a free trade zone, this is about free trade, ultimately, this discontent is about free trade. You don't hear them talk about that in the press and in the media, but that's what it is underlying it all. And I'll explain why. You know, when you got this problem with free trade, all free trade agreements mean that countries give up their some of their political and democratic sovereignty. That's what free trade is, and that's true with NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it was true in England, in the UK as well, as part of the EU. You give your country gives up your parliament in this case, cannot pass laws that contradict or in any way challenge or negate the bureaucratic decisions of these pan cross-country new bureaucratic political institutions. Free trade is a treaty, and if you agree to the treaty, you cannot contradict the treaty. In other words, when you when a free trade agreement is negotiated, it's kind of a legislative act done not by elected representatives, but by the representatives of big corporations, pretty much. You know, you may have some government representatives there doing actual negotiations, but all these big corporations are right at their elbow, and they're the ones determining what's being negotiated. So you've got unelected people, pan-European people, in these bureaucracies, new political bureaucracies, become a kind of a legislature, kind of of an appointed legislature. It's not really a legislature elected by the people throughout Europe, you see. When I'm talking about the European Commission and European Central Bank, for example, in Europe. So if the European Commission passes some regulation, you know, the British Parliament cannot soften the negative impact of that on its populace because you've got a treaty, you've got another higher legislated decision. And your parliament cannot do that. Well, you know, over time, people become resentful that they've given up their domestic sovereignty. You know, their own elected officials cannot defend their interests against the treaty. It's prohibited. Right? And you also have courts. You know, these free trade agreements have their own special courts so that your own domestic court system cannot render decisions that contradict the decisions of the treaty courts. So you're giving up judicial representation, you're giving up legislative representation. Now, this is not a great problem, generally, so long as you got economic recovery and economic growth. People overlook this stuff. But when you have an economic problem, which has existed since 2008-09, then people become much more aware of it. Because it becomes a wake-up call. Well, wait a minute, you know, my wages are down, and I'm losing benefits and so forth, and my parliament is telling me, my representatives tell me he can't pass laws because it contradicts this free trade treaty. You know, therefore, the economic stress that people feel gets identified with the free trade treaty, but maybe not the treaty itself, but with the idea of we've lost our sovereignty, and oh, it's these bureaucrats over there in Brussels, because that's where, you know, it's sort of located, the EU, they're the ones responsible. So the Brexit vote is a vote for reestablishing sovereignty, but that sovereignty is an issue that's created because of the free trade treaty itself. Right. So that's what I mean when I say that underlies it. Now, there's another parallel issue here with a free trade treaty, and that is in Europe. Free trade means the unlimited, unrestricted flows of goods, products, but unrestricted flows of money capital. Free trade is even more about direct investment by corporations, right? And it's also requires the in the European version free movement of labor. Well, what's happened in the UK is that you've had this massive flow of immigration into the UK, and it's not really Syria and the Middle East. If you look at the numbers of the immigration, it's from Eastern Europe. As the EU has added all these members from Eastern Europe, which it quickly did to try to grab those countries from any influence from Russia in the post-Soviet period. They quickly added all these, you know, Latvia and Poland and all these East European countries and threw them under NATO umbrella immediately as well. So politically, they added all these countries in the EU. Once that existed, once they're in the EU, these people could just migrate anywhere to Western Europe. Well, the jobs at the time were in, you know, France and UK and Germany and so forth. So they migrated, particularly, to the UK. You know, most of the big surge in immigration in the UK has come from Eastern Europe. Well, when you get that kind of a quick and large, inflow of, immigrant labor, it has an effect on wages. Okay, it does drive wages down. There's no doubt about it. You know, some liberal economists don't want to admit that, but it does have an effect on wages, especially if it comes too quick, too fast. You see, and that's what's basically happened here. So you know, you got this problem. At the same time, capitalists throughout the West, you know, both Europe and the U.S. and so forth, have moved towards these new forms of labor market relationships in which all they're hiring is part-time and temp work. You know, if you look at Europe in the past year, 90% of all the jobs that were created were all temp jobs, part-time temp jobs. So it's kind of like creating a second class of economic citizen that's occurring everywhere. Now, and now we got this other wave I've talked about called the sharing gig economy on top of all this. Well, you know, after a while, people get upset with the fact that, you know, all they've got is part-time temp work. And they see all the immigrants coming in and they say, well, you know, that must be because of that, even though it may not be. It's the perception that matters in this case. And then there's a cultural problem reaction here. You know, when people come into the country in large numbers, speaking a different language with different customs and so forth, and people, you know, the natives that were there already see them getting jobs, and they may not be able to get a job because of, in the case of the UK, the austerity program, you see. It was overlaid on all this. And you wouldn't have as strong a reaction by working classes in the UK in this vote that we've seen if it wasn't for the immigration, which is because of the EU, if it wasn't for the fact there's been no real recovery for most working classes, and they've seen their wages stagnating, and they've seen poor quality jobs is all they've been able to get, you wouldn't have this reaction if the economy was better. But because it's bad, they identify with the immigrants. To some extent, it's true because wages are reduced and there's more competition for jobs. But it's really also UK Cameron austerity policies. Austerity mean, you know, let's cut benefits, let's cut the National Health Service here. Let's cut subsidies, various kind for housing and so forth. All that has been occurring, and it's been impacting the industrial areas of Britain. If you look at the vote for the Brexit here, what you see is that the massive vote to leave in the industrial heartland of England, you know, what they call the Midlands and Wales and the Northeast and so forth, the votes to stay in the EU have been around London and the vicinity, as well as Scotland and Northern Ireland. You know, it's a real split in the electorate, but it's a class-based split, and it's a split based on the economy, because London has done fairly well. It has recovered compared to you know, the rest, but that recovery, even in London and in vicinity, southern England, we should say, is very ephemeral. In other words, it was based on money inflows, capital inflows, from emerging markets and China, for example. A lot of deals have been struck between the UK and China to rebuild infrastructure. It's been a property-based boom in London vicinity, both commercial property and residential property, prices of which were driven way up because of the monetary policies of the Bank of England. Same phenomenon happened here in the U.S. and elsewhere. So it was really based on financial assets, you know, money flows and property valuations and so forth, and some infrastructure development. And now that's coming to an end, you see. It's already been lagging here. So, you know, either even in southern England, London, the growth is very temporary. Economic growth. Well, now they're going to have a recession, no doubt. But the point, original point here is that the class arrangements are very evident in this vote. Those who have been harmed by British austerity policies, Cameron austerity policies, you know, when you cut the payments to, you know, the subsidies to social spending, to the National Health and Service, and you cut it for housing and so forth. Then you see all these immigrants come in, and you see them in the hospitals, you know, many of them, and you see them getting you know, some kind of housing. People have to live somewhere. You know, in the mind of the average voter, they associate my economic problems, you know, jobs and wages and so forth, and lack of benefits. Well, it must be because of these immigrants. Well, it's because, primarily, even more so, because of austerity policies. See, we have this overlay of monetary bank central bank based expansion, which benefits investors and businesses and the top 10%, right? But not the rest of the populace. And I talked about that before. And that's everywhere. That's in the U.S. That's in Japan. That's in Europe. Right, this whole monetary central bank approach bails out and boosts the financial assets of the rich, causing extreme inequality, and it leaves everyone else kind of struggling and behind. You know, that's why in the U.S. this whole problem has resulted in $5 trillion in distribution, corporate distribution to shareholders of dividends and stock buybacks and so forth, $5 trillion. That's just the U.S. Well, that's a reflection of this monetary approach to recovery, which leaves us with this stop-go epic recession scenario that I've been talking about here. Well, you know, in the U.K., it's left most of the working class and small businesses and local producers behind. It's benefited the financial asset folks, particularly in the city of London, the bankers and so forth, and it's those who are large companies that export to the EU and elsewhere, but it's left everyone else pretty much behind. And now you see this vote, you know, this discontent with free trade and austerity policies and no recovery is being reflected in the breakup of the European Union. And the UK is just the first of what's coming. You know, there are significant movements elsewhere in Europe, and you can see it reflected in the rise of independent parties challenging, you know, from the right and the left. You know, quote on the left, you have Podemos in Spain, the Five Star Movement in Italy. You have movements in the Netherlands, and we also see it, you know, Syriza maybe, although they haven't gotten very far. You see it on the right as well. You know, Austria almost went Nazi, and the National Front is certainly going to defeat the socialists in the elections in France next year. No doubt about it. Holland is just, the president of France has just shot himself in the foot with these labor market reforms. He's toast. And the rise of these independent parties, left and right, is reflective as well of the collapse of traditional social democracy, social democratic parties in Europe. They've either aligned themselves with the neoliberal arrangements, as in Germany, for example. Social Democrats are junior partners in the Merkel government over there, or they've pretty much eliminated themselves. I mean, look at the Labour Party in Britain. You know, they supported Remain, stay in. You know, the Brexit vote, no. You know, which means they've supported the, you know, a Remain recommendation is to support the British bankers and support the British corporations that are involved in exports to Europe. And you can just see this, that Corbyn, who's the head of the Labour Party over there, you know, being pressured by his unions that are aligned with their corporations on staying in the EU to keep their jobs. Because, you know, if you exit, some of these corporations are going to move businesses and jobs to the continent. So Corbyn and the Labour Party, you know, Gordon Brown before, Prime Minister, Labour Prime Minister, and all of them come out in support of remaining, you know. Don't exit. No Brexit. Remain. You know, leave is Brexit. The leave movement and remain was the stay in. Well, you know, in elections here, it has been 52-48% to leave, and over a million more votes to of the electorate to leave. You know, in this vote yesterday. Right. So. You know, the origins of this Brexit, to summarize, is really really lay in the economic problems, the austerity problems throughout Europe, and the whole free trade arrangement, which benefits certain corporations and wealthy and causes losses for the rest. You see, free trade is results in a leavening of for the working classes. The rich on both sides do well, right? They realign and, you know, whatever your competitive advantage is in your particular country, you know, those companies grow and, you know, vice versa in the other countries. So corporations do well from free trade. But the gains from free trade are not distributed down, you see, because they don't have to, right? Everywhere, you know, corporations are super profits everywhere, and they're just not redistributing it. And that's part of the problem of income inequality, right? Investors and financial bankers and so forth are getting filthier rich, but they're not sharing it. They're squeezing the working classes, right? All you get is crummy part-time, low-quality, no-benefit, low-pay jobs, right? Temp, part-time, gig, and at the same time, corporations and the big corporation, multinational, the big banks are sitting on trillions and trillions of cash. And they're not using it to create jobs. And that's why we say global investment, real investment, and real job growth is shrinking. Productivity is declining globally. Trade is slowing down globally. And wage incomes are not rising. By the way, you know, they say, oh, wages are rising. They usually use an average indicator, average wages, which means the wages and the salaries on the top end are growing very fast, so it looks like the average is growing a little bit, right? But if you look at the median, the true middle, wages have been declining in the UK and in the US and in Europe. They've been declining. Well, you know, when you fire people and you hire two part-timers back, you know, it's going to be a wage decline. Right? And then you let the minimum wage not grow, and then you destroy unions, and you know the union wage differential disappears, and then you take away benefits. You know, it's a decline in standards in the middle and below. But the very rich, you know, top salary people. I mean, you know, if you're a software engineer in Silicon Valley, you're doing okay, right? But, you know, everybody else, if you're a student and you come out of college and you got no job, you take a part-time temp job and you kind of try to figure out how you're going to pay your debt, your student debt. You know, good luck. So it's economic problems that really underlay this Brexit vote in Europe. The European Union, the customs union, the free trade zone is part of that. And then you throw on top of that all this immigration from Eastern Europe, and you got and people become aware of the sovereignty issue. So you got immigration, you got economic stagnation, or worse, you got immigration, cultural reflections of that follow, and discontent, and you got sovereignty, and that's why you have this movement here for let's leave the free trade zone, you know, and stop this immigration, and maybe that's the solution to our problems. But it really is a response to neoliberalism, because free trade is one of the hallmarks of neoliberalism. You see, integrate the capitalist markets here more tightly for goods and money flows. That's what it's all about. Okay, and then you overlay austerity politics on top of this, which exacerbates the whole thing, right? So inequality follows, right? And that results in what's called, in Europe at least, Euroscepticism, right? And that led, the rising Euroscepticism vote is what a year ago Cameron tried to tap into, and struck his Faustian bargain, as I said, with the voters, and now the devil has come back and wants its money. It wants payment, and it got his head. You know, Cameron this morning resigned, says he's going to resign. Well, he should. They should throw that guy out. He's the guy who precipitated, instigated, for his own personal political gain, all this accelerated, this whole process of political instability. They should throw him out, you know? They should have threw him out before. I mean, this was just a, you know, personal gain here. Well, it wasn't totally personal gain, because it was pretty clear in the run-up to last year's May 2015 parliamentary election in the UK that the Conservatives were concerned that they might not win because of the UKIP party, UKIP, the independent party, which is pushing very hard for this nationalist theme of exiting from the EU. Well, clearly, the Conservatives and Cameron, and there were some people within his own Conservative Party, had a similar view, they weren't going to let the UKIP outflank them on the right on this issue during the election. So there were personal reasons that Cameron went for this referendum vote promise, but there were also political reasons as well within the Conservative Party. Don't let the UKIP cut into us, cut into our vote. So that was, you know, the political origins of this, but, you know, the real origins are the economic in the Heartland and the Midlands, as they call it, Birmingham, places like that, Wales, Northeast, you know, Newcastle and so forth. All right. But there were splits emerged in this vote within the Conservative Party, the UK. This guy, Boris Johnson, who was a Conservative mayor of London, sensed that there was a real opportunity for himself here. And, you know, he came out in support of his split. The split in the Conservatives became public. He came out in support of the Brexit. Right? So even within his own party, we have that arrangement. You know, that would be like, you know, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, saying, well, I'm against TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, and I think, Congress ought to vote it down. You know, it was similar. I mean, a big split, right? And the consequence of this growing economic crisis in Europe and crisis in the belief in the free trade European Union arrangement is now taking political expression in a number of ways, number of fronts, as I said, the rise of these independent parties, but also splits in the traditional parties. And we're going to see a split now in the Labour Party, right? Corbyn made a big mistake of taking a position against the class on behalf of the unions and the corporations, you know, because the Labour Party, as a decadent kind of social democratic party, just as the German social SPD is a decadent social democratic party, and the same with the Socialist Party, really decadent. And by decadent, I mean they have abandoned their own traditional positions and assumed increasingly neoliberal alliance kind of positions with the ruling class conservative parties. Right? We've seen that in the Democratic Party in the U.S. You know, under Clinton, Bill Clinton became, you know, a real promoter of neoliberalism in the U.S. and, you know, the SPD in Germany, and now you know, Socialist Party Hollande, President Hollande, you know, doing the bidding and trying to step on French workers and unions with these labor market reforms. So everywhere, you know, the traditional social democratic parties, and you see it more clearly in Europe, but even in the U.S., are in decline and breaking up, and that gives space for these new parties on the left and the right to rise in the crisis situation here. There's an anti-party sentiment sweeping everywhere. Conservative parties, i.e. Republicans in the U.S. and conservative Tories in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, and splits in the parties beginning to emerge. But the electorate, the populace, you know, is turning anti-establishment parties. You know, these are the parties that they identify now with the crisis that occurred and the lack of recovery for them that has followed. You know, this is the identification. So we have this big anti-party, establishment party, kind of a movement going on in the advanced economies, Europe, North America, Japan. That's not so developed in Japan because of certain cultural factors there and very weak liberal parties. But in any event, certainly in North America and in Europe, this phenomenon is occurring. Right? Now, that has consequences. You know, I mean, what happened in the UK with Brexit should be a red flag for Hillary Clinton. Because if you look at the U.S., these votes, you know, for Sanders, you know, on the left, and for Trump, right, are a reflection of throw the SOBs out. I don't care, you know, what they say, what these new candidates who are running say, just get rid of the old, because they're identified with my problems. They don't do anything for me, and it's clear they're doing everything for their rich campaign contributors and nothing for me, so throw them out. I don't care what Trump says. Throw these guys out. If he can throw them out, good. Now, he's really part of them, you know, he's a billionaire, but he's pandering, he's talking the talk to what people want to hear, and he's pandering to the anger and discontent, and so was Sanders in a more rational way, right? But Trump and Sanders are smart enough to know there's a rising wave of discontent going on, and they're trying in different ways to plug into it. Well, Sanders has been stymied. Well, he's stymied because, you know, from the get-go, in order to get on a platform, he said he'd support Hillary Clinton. And, of course, that's exactly what's happening. You can read some of my articles on my blog on predicting all this as well. Right? But at the heart, it's a discontent with austerity policies and free trade policies, i.e. neoliberalism everywhere. That's at the core of all this. Now, what's going to happen in the U.K., right, politically, is there will be elections, a new election. Now that Cameron says he's backing down, he doesn't want to go and negotiate what he said he didn't want to do. So he's backing down, and there will be new elections in the U.K., parliamentary elections in October. We will have elections in Spain in a couple days. And then there will be the U.S. elections in November. And then German and French elections, national elections, next, I think, May, June. Okay? So the U.K. is not going to be able to negotiate. Whoever is in the driver's seat in the U.K., negotiate and achieve any end results with the EU until after those elections. We have a whole year of just spinning of wheels and uncertainty, political and economic uncertainty. That does not harbor well very for European economy, you know, the uncertainty, or the UK economy, or the US for that matter, right? Now, as I said in my articles, just because you have this vote, referendum, doesn't mean they're exiting the EU. Yes, I mean, the Brexit vote does not mean an exit, necessarily. You see, Article 50 of the European Union Treaty requires the host country that wants to leave to activate Article 50, saying it wants to leave. And then Article 50 says negotiations can go on for 2 years, after which, if there's no agreement on leaving, they're automatically brought back in to the Union. Interesting, huh? Well, we're going to see negotiations at least going on for 2 years, at least. You know, as I said, nothing will be agreed to until France and Germany have their re-election. You might have an agreement 2 years from now, or you might not. Article 50, if it's activated, can only be activated by a vote of the British Parliament. In other words, British Parliament now has to vote to leave. Will there be a vote? Well, there certainly won't be a vote until October, will there? That will activate Article 50, and then it will be 2 years from October for negotiations to continue. In the meantime, a lot of uncertainty is going to occur. Right? And businesses are not going to wait. They're going to relocate. Right? And we'll see whether in the interim the free trade arrangements between EU and UK continue as is. We don't know. Because certainly the Germans and others on the continent don't want this long-term uncertainty. They want the UK to make a decision right now. Well, the UK is not going to make a decision. The negotiations are going to drag out. And that's going to have a deleterious effect on the economies in these countries, right? That's an important thing to know, right? It doesn't mean automatic exit, right? It means that the process is only beginning. And watch the conservatives and the business interest in the UK try to maneuver. They're going to try to say that this Brexit vote was just advisory, you know, suggesting the Parliament, that Parliament still has to make the decision. Will the British Parliament make the decision to activate Article 50? We don't know. Right? We'll just have to see. Now, I've been talking about the political consequences of all this. What are the economic consequences? Well, we've seen them already. You know, immediately what you see is currency volatility. The British pound dropped 10% initially. It's come back a little bit here over the course of the day, right? The British pound collapsing means if you're holding investments in pounds, you lost a lot of money. So people, investors, you know, financial speculators and investors have been trying to get out of the pound, trying to sell the pound and buy dollars. Why? Because the dollar's going to rise. The dollar is a safe haven. If you want to buy U.S. treasuries, this is a safe haven, you got to buy dollars to buy the treasury. Right? That's the way exchange rate currencies go. Okay, so you're buying dollars, the demand for dollars goes up, the value of the dollar goes up. So when the British pound goes down, the dollar goes up. The British pound goes down, the euro is going to go down as well. With a lag here, not as fast, but it's going to decline as well. So the pound and the euro are going to decline, are declining. Right? The dollar is going up. Also going up is the Japanese yen, because it's a safe haven currency. Called the carry trade. People, you know, they just buy yen as a holding operation, you see, and then they'll reconvert it back out. Well, the yen, the Japanese yen, has been rising already significantly and causing all kind of problems in Japan, because if the value of your currency rises, your exports decline. Japan is a very much export-oriented country. So, you know, its economy already in the fifth recession since 2009 is going to get much worse. And the whole Abenomics phenomenon there, named after the Prime Minister Shinzo Abenomics, is going to collapse. At some point, the government over there, Abe, is going to collapse as well. Because the economic conditions are going to deteriorate even worse than they are today. In the meantime, the central bank of Japan is going to pump even more money, more QE, into the economy, drive down government bond rates even further. See, the collapsing currencies in the UK and the EU are also going to result in the central bank, Bank of England, European Central Bank, policies of injecting more liquidity into the economy. In fact, in Britain, they already indicated, the Bank of England, that they were putting aside $350 billion to use as necessary to keep the currency from falling too far. Again, protect those values and the wealth of the rich, you know. Central banks will spend hundreds of billions of dollars on their behalf, but not a penny on behalf of the average worker or small business. Central banks are all about protecting bankers. All right. So, you know, central bank liquidity injections is going to cause interest rates already in negative territory for government bonds, soon for corporate bonds, pushing farther into negative territory. We already have $10 trillion globally in negative interest rates in government bonds. Well, the further injection in Japan and in Europe, where most of these negative rates exist already, is going to drive it even lower. And that is really destabilizing the whole financial system, these negative interest rates. You know, really a radical, desperate move by central banks. Right. Well, they bail out their banker buddies first and worry about these problems afterwards. Okay, so a consequence, you know, another consequence is going to be more negative interest rates and more central bank monetary injections into the economies to deal with collapsing currencies and currency volatility. You're going to see it particularly in Europe and in Japan. Now, it also means for the United States, if money is flowing out of these countries in trouble, in these regions, UK and Europe, Japan in trouble, it's driving up the value of the dollar. Well, the value of the dollar rising means long-term U.S. interest rates are going to continue to rise as well. You know, whether or not the Federal Reserve does anything about short-term rates, that's another topic. The Federal Reserve does not control long-term rates. It only influences short-term rates. But if long-term rates are rising, well, then the Federal Reserve is not going to raise short-term rates, too. Because rising rates, a rising value of the dollar and rising value of interest rates, you know, makes U.S. corporations' exports less competitive. And it slows down the economy, long-term investment. You know, the investment trend is going to continue to slow globally even faster than it was. And if you don't have investment, you don't have productivity, which is now negative everywhere. And if you don't have if productivity is falling, you don't have hiring. In fact, you get layoffs. So we're going to see more of that. And you get layoffs, you have less income, less consumption, less GDP. So it's going to have a depressing effect on the economy in the U.S. as well as everywhere else. And the Federal Reserve now will not raise rates, at least, I say, probably through 2017. There'll be no interest rate increases off the table now with this Brexit thing, unless it totally reverses, which it could. You know, in my article, I predict that, you know, you'll have an initial significant collapse of financial asset prices, you know, it could stabilize pretty quickly as well. And not just stock prices. Stock markets, of course, are collapsing. Well, I would say collapsing, but they're declining significantly. You'll have to wait till next week to see really what happens to the stock markets, because if there's enough of a decline now, those who have bought stocks on margin are going to have to sell, and that will mean another round of another decline next week and in coming weeks. So currency collapse and volatility, stock market equity prices collapse and volatility, bond prices collapse, particularly in Europe. These are all consequences of this move. You see, the global economy was very, very unstable going into this. As I wrote at length in my 500-page book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, published early this year. You can get some free chapters from that. Go to my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, or go to Clarity Press. They've got a lot of samples, you know, you can look at on the book. But I predicted all this at the end of last year. The book book was published earlier this year, of how this was going to occur, and that the global economy was becoming increasingly fragile. When it becomes fragile, events like Brexit might be the event that pushes it over the top, you see. And then you get all this big financial asset price collapses going on, which we see with stocks. You know, that's financial asset, bonds, financial asset, right? Foreign currency exchange declining, that's a financial asset. Mm-hmm. And if you get enough of these collapsing, then you get corporate defaults, and then you get pullback of investment, and then you get real economic recession occurring. And the economies are growing so slowly everywhere, it won't take much of a real response to the financial asset collapses to push it into a global recession. I've been predicting that the U.S. recession is going to occur early in 2017, but it could even accelerate here. But not likely, because in election year, the U.S. government pumps up the economy before the election. But certainly immediately thereafter, we're going to have a recession in the U.S., bona fide. Europe, U.K., Japan, even before that. Right. I talked about the impact of all this economically on the U.S., and you know, property prices is another asset collapse, which we're going to see in London now, because there was a false boom there, and in the U.S. eventually. You know, I haven't said about what's the impact on China and emerging markets. Well, that's going to be significant as well, right? If the value of the dollar is rising in the U.S. because the money's flowing into the safe haven here, treasuries in the U.S., interest rates are rising and the dollar is rising in the U.S., we're going to see a renewal of capital flight from emerging markets. It's going to really have an impact on Latin America and some other places, make it even worse. The economies are already in trouble, right? And, of course, to try to stem the outflow, these countries will raise their interest rates. Raising their interest rates, they're going to slow their economies even more. That was a big problem in Brazil. You know, the central bank there, which the Workers' Party had no control over, raised interest rates and provoked this deep recession that they have. And, of course, the Workers' Party got blamed for all of this. But in China, what you're going to see is a possible devaluation of the yuan, their currency, which is in a band now, trading in a band, but it's at the, you know, the bottom of that band and pushing against that band. You're going to have more capital flight out of China, which is a problem, although the Chinese have been able to control some of it, but even more now will occur, moving to the U.S. But that will depress their currency. And if the Chinese devalue their currency beyond their band, that will be a shock heard around the world. And we will enter another phase of the global slowdown, which we've already begun to enter, I believe, with this Brexit. Okay, that's my analysis of this whole picture here, politically and economically, and we'll watch it continually going forward. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.